The solutions to planet-sized puzzles often begin at the molecular scale. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week as every week from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Mars has a complex and enticing history, which after several robotic missions we're still only beginning to understand. Questions about how wet and how warm it was, and when and how volcanic processes ended, are central to sketching out the evolution of that world. And just like on Earth, the rocks are key to many of these puzzles. What looks to the untrained eye like an empty, endless, dusty desert conceals within it the record of the planet's past. Each rock tells the story of the environment of its formation, and the materials available to form it. When layers of rock overlie each other, still in their place of origin, their spatial relationships reveal the order of their formation. This established, careful comparison of the compositions of the rocks along the timeline can reveal how the world that made them changed over time. But often this requires very fine geochemical analyses, using all the tools of modern physics. Dr. Marieke Schmidt of Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, is a participating scientist on the Mars Science Laboratory mission. In her work, she pieces together the history of the Earth and of Mars by studying the nature of their rocky surfaces from the large to the minute scale. I spoke to Dr. Schmidt at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in The Woodlands, Texas. So Dr. Schmidt, welcome to the program, and thanks for taking the time to be with us. Now, you're working on the Mars Science Lab as a participating scientist.
Yes.
So what does that imply about how you're connected to the mission? What does that mean?
Okay, so the participating scientists are a group of scientists that were selected after the rover was built, and we were selected to basically be not associated with an instrument necessarily, but to be more independent, and we can interpret the data. We do operations. So we're just, you know, a cohort of scientists.
Okay. But part of the mission team.
But part of the mission team.
Okay.
Yeah, but we were not part of the mission from its conception, whereas a lot of people who are on the mission are.
Okay.
So that's, I guess, one of the bigger distinctions. But also we have a bit more independence than the people that are associated with the instrument teams.
In which way?
In that if you're on an instrument team, you basically can only work on that instrument. It's not that hard set, but you have enough responsibilities to your instrument that you're less likely to migrate over and work with other ones.
So you're sort of scientists at large on the mission.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's fun.
And I do work with an instrument. I work with a APXS, or Alpha Particle X-ray Spectrometer, but it's not the only thing that I do.
Okay. So what is the APXS?
What it does, it's an instrument that's on the rover's arm. Mm-hmm. And so the rover can extend its arm and lay the APXS down on a rock or a soil and determine the elemental composition of the rock surface. So it uses alpha particles and X-rays to determine what we call major elements. So basically from sodium to bromine on the periodic table we're able to analyze. So we don't actually get carbon or hydrogen or oxygen. We get those sort of middle to heavy elements.
Okay, so sort of in the metals part of the of the things that you might find in the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you generate X-rays, and how do you get them, interrogate a rock's structure with that?
Oh, well, it uses so there are curium sources. Curium-242, I believe, is the source, and that emits alpha particles and X-rays during decay of that source. And it basically bombards the rock and interacts with the atoms in that rock, and those then it excites the atoms so that that electrons jump to outer orbitals, and then those electrons, when they become unexcited, they fall back down and release X-rays, and they're characteristic to that particular element.
to detect those X-rays, and from their frequencies, mm-hmm. you can tell what the rock is made
yeah.
of at the
yeah.
elemental level.
Yeah.
Okay. And why is that useful? What benefit do we have from having such a device on the rover?
Oh, it does a lot.
Yeah?
Okay, so what it does is it allows us to classify rocks. We can figure out what's different, what's similar about this rock compared to another rock. We can compare it with other rocks that have been analyzed on Mars. So this APXS is actually the fourth such instrument that was sent to Mars. There was one on the Pathfinder mission. There were two on the Mars exploration rovers. So Spirit and Opportunity both have an APXS, and now this is the fourth generation.
The newest and best, I suspect.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Newest and best. So what's different about this one is it has a cooler on it.
Okay.
So that allows... On Spirit and Opportunity, they could only do APXS measurements at night when it was cold enough because it makes the spectrum more messy when it's warm.
You have to get the noise down?
Yeah, basically get the noise down. And then, so this one we have a Peltier cooler on the rovers to cool off the instrument.
So you can run in the day.
We can run it during the day. And also, for that reason, we can do good quality spectral analysis for shorter periods of time. Mm-hmm. So on Spirit and Opportunity, the minimum measurement is probably 6 hours. Now we can get it down to 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a big improvement.
Yeah, and during the day, too. So okay. it's a huge improvement.
Okay. So almost a touch-and-go thing now.
Yeah. And you can interrogate different parts of the rock. You can interrogate different parts of the rock in one sol. So, you know, if they're different, you want to compare two different parts of the rock to see how homogeneous or heterogeneous the rock is. Also, if there are textural distinctions between different parts of the rock, you want to see whether or not that's really reflected in the geochemistry.
So several quick measurements at once are possible in what used to take a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. So is APXS kind of a standalone investigation, or does it complement the rest of the instrument suite?
Yeah, it complements everything else. So on the rover's arm, there's also a hand lens imager, the Mars hand lens imager, or MOLLE, and that tells us the microscale textures of the rock, and it's really complementary to APXS because we want to know what we're actually analyzing looks like, what the rock textures are, but also how much soil or dust cover is on the rock. So this rover has capabilities that other rovers haven't had. It can drill rocks. And so in this case, what we want to do is to figure out which are the best ones to drill, because that's a really time-intensive process. And so the APXS allows us to, you know, understand the geochemistry and figure out whether or not it's worthwhile to do that. The APXS is also not the only instrument that determines elemental compositions. There's the ChemCam, mm-hmm. which is, it shoots a laser at a rock and ablates the rock, and that gives us chemical composition as well. So the APXS, it integrates over a spot size. It's about a centimeter and a half across, whereas the ChemCam is like 200 to 300 micron spots on a rock.
Tiny little
spots.
Yeah.
So they're really complementary to each other.
Okay. So earlier this week, you were part of the press release mm-hmm. team where MSL made some new announcements about what they found, including data from APXS.
Yes.
So what did you tell the world?
Okay, so last week in Washington, D.C., there was a huge press briefing.
Yeah.
That involved the project scientist, John Grotzinger, as well as several of the PIs, and it was at NASA headquarters to announce that we have discovered smectite clays in the drill hole, mm-hmm. and that this is really good evidence that Mars was habitable at one time. So that's like one step away from discovering life, because we need to confirm that life could have possibly existed on Mars before we can actually, you know, find life.
So we haven't found life, but we found that it's livable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We found it's livable. So what this press briefing was about was to sort of fill in the gaps that what the other instruments tell us about that discovery of smectite clays.
Okay.
And so what I did was I showed some analyses to emphasize the fact that all the rocks that we analyzed in this one particular area where we drilled, they're pretty much all basalts in composition. So they have basaltic silicone, aluminum, magnesium, iron concentrations.
Okay.
So really, this stuff that we're analyzing, it's basically run-of-the-mill Mars.
Okay.
So it's not unusual. And it's Mars. Mars is a basaltic planet.
Yeah.
And all the compositions for 20-something rocks that I presented, they're all really similar to one another.
But many of them are sedimentary rocks.
Yeah, they're sedimentary rocks, but they're basaltic in composition. So what this indicates then is that whatever alteration occurred to make those clay minerals, because those smectite clays are an alteration mineral. They're not an igneous mineral. They don't crystallize from lava flows.
Right.
So whatever alteration occurred that did not affect the elemental composition of that rock.
Okay, so it wasn't something that was preferentially leaching out one element or something.
No, it's basically occurring in place. And so what I think is really important about that is that we have to keep in mind that pretty much everything on, not everything, but a lot of Mars is basalt. The soils are basalts. It's basically run-of-the-mill Mars is okay. Basalt. So you have to consider then that the building blocks for a habitable environment exist everywhere on Mars.
Oh, okay. So this environment has a livable environment.
Yeah, this environment.
And it's not special.
No, it's not special chemically. It has, so the mineral change, you know, has not affected the composition. And so that means that that rock intrinsically has the building blocks or is the substrate for a habitable environment. And you have to have the conditions be right in order for it to be habitable. But the basic underlying composition is a good starting place.
So we've got the foundation for this kind of environment almost everywhere on Mars, as long as the conditions that are imposed on it are suitable.
Yeah, so those conditions being, you know, you need to have water available, which is everybody talks about finding water on Mars. You also have to have, you know, a relatively neutral pH. I mean, there are extremophiles on Earth that can live in, like, very bizarre extreme environments. But if we have a very, you know, normal, not too acidic, not too basic, middle of the road.
Friendly and familiar.
Yeah, friendly environment, that's a good place. Not too oxidizing, not too reduced. And one of the things we found in this rock is the presence of both oxidized and reduced forms of iron and sulfur. Okay, and so both of those then suggest that through oxidation or reduction, it would be a potential energy source for microbes.
Oh, instead of sunlight or something, they could use this chemical difference in the rocks.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's promising.
Yeah, totally.
So, is this the goal that you have with the project? Is this kind of characterization of rocks, or what's your own?
The proposal that I wrote was, knowing that we were going to be looking at sedimentary rocks. I'm actually, I work on igneous rocks. But knowing that sedimentary rocks are laid down in layers, that I was going to track a long strike and a cross strike geochemical variations.
Okay. So along and across the layers? Or?
Yeah. So across the layers is what we call a cross strike. Mm-hmm. And so that gives us a change with time because the older stuff is laid down first and then the younger stuff is deposited on top of that. So that gives us a history, okay? And that records primary deposition, more or less. There can be changes. It's not always true, but that can record primary deposition of the rock. But if you track how one rock changes in composition from one place and then trace it out to another place where it crops out.
Along the same layer?
Along the same layer. If there's a change in composition or in oxidation state or something, it might tell you something about alteration gradients.
Okay.
And what kind of fluids and chemical reactions were going on with that rock.
So what about outside of the MSL mission? You said igneous rocks?
Yes, I do. I work on volcanic fields, the history of volcanic fields, their long-term history. So working out the eruptive history as well as how magma compositions change with time. Mm-hmm. as well as how alteration of those minerals or alteration of those rocks, how they can maybe be a paleoclimate indicator.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they, you know, whether or not there's water present or what was the characteristic of that water to form that alteration.
Because that affects the way the rocks form and then later evolve.
How they form and then how they're altered later on.
Okay. And do you do comparative studies from Mars and Earth, or?
I do analogs as well, but I think it's more that I feel like Mars kind of pushes me into being interested in certain kinds of volcanoes, but I don't see myself as being strictly somebody who wants to prove that this is possible on another planet, which
right.
is what a lot of what analog studies are. I want to be able to contribute to the understanding of volcanic fields on Earth as well as on other planets.
So not just with the goal of mm-hmm. Mars work. So what kind of places on Earth do you look for those features?
So one place where I have a project that's ongoing is the Fort Rock volcanic field in Central Oregon.
Okay.
It's a place where during glacial times there was a big lake, and today it's a desert.
Oh, all right.
It's a flat desert. But when that lake was present, a lot of little volcanoes formed in and around that lake.
Mm-hmm.
So those volcanic landforms reflect the volcanic style that produced those landforms, and the rocks themselves reflect how much water was present at the time of their formation.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what we're interested in. It's like backing out how we can use volcanoes to understand the climate history and the environmental history of this particular site.
Okay, so in similar to the way that glaciologists look at the deposition history of tills and things and try and figure
yeah.
out how many glaciations there were.
Yeah, but you know, like glaciologists, they're sort of, they can only go so far in
yeah.
time.
Before it's all been scraped away.
Yeah, before it's been scraped away, because so the last time that they can really get to is the last glacial maximum,
mm-hmm.
which was about 12,000 years ago. And then after that, because that was when glaciers were the most extended, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the glaciers have retreated and advanced and retreated and advanced and then more or less disappeared.
Okay.
to today.
Yeah.
I mean, they're obviously still present. But what we can do with volcanic rocks, which is distinctive, is that we can get a radiometric age is much older than 12,000 years. So being able to record the history up to 100,000 years, 200,000 years, or 500,000 years, you know, that's sort of the time frame that I'm looking at in this particular volcanic field. But you can, obviously, volcanic rocks are much, much older than that in some instances. So this kind of technique can be extended to others, to other time periods as well.
Okay, so another clock for a longer and
mm-hmm.
distant time.
Yep.
Well, thanks for speaking to us today, and good luck figuring out that chronicle of history and the NSL mission.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
From Brock University, and you know, it's not every professor who gets to work on MSL as a participating scientist, so that's a pretty cool position to be in.
Yeah, I really loved how you first asked what is a participating scientist, you know. Not everyone knows how MSL and all the sciences on it works, you know. People think, okay, oh, you have set people who send the spacecraft and they are the ones who control it or whatever, right? But it's not actually how it works. There's a team that designs, you know, the science it should do and how it works. And you actually work on MSL too, right?
That's right. And actually, so my connection with the mission is also through the Participating Scientist Program. John Moores, who our listeners will remember from previous seasons here on Western World, is also a Participating Scientist. And I'm connected to the project through him. But yeah, it's pretty cool. And it's not every mission that is organized this way, but MSL is very large, very complex, very capable system, and we need a very large and very capable team to be able to do that. And so after the design, as Dr. Schmidt mentioned, they put out actually a call for proposals for who had ideas of what science could be done with the system as designed,
And among those selected were the proposals of Dr. Smith and Dr. Moore's, you know, new science that you could achieve, and new people, new sort of manpower to help on the mission.
Yeah, I really liked her idea of how comparing, you know, because she does science here on Earth, and she uses the same science on Mars to figure out the history of both Earth and Mars. And that's particularly cool because now we are looking through the eyes of MSL, you know, and trying to look at different layers, as you said, on Mars. And that's pretty cool to understand, just like here, if we go, you know, either to a crater or, you know, some, for example, Grand Canyon, and you look at different layers that are present in the structure, and you can figure out what happened when and what kind of, you know, atmospheric composition they were, what kind of conditions they were present at the time of the formation of this kind of rock or this kind of layer. So I found that pretty cool.
Yeah, and the MSL landing site in Gale Crater is maybe one of the very best places to do that kind of work. That mountain in the middle of the crater that they're calling Mount Sharp, it may be the longest stratigraphic sequence in the solar system that's exposed and available. So there's, you know, the more we're able to interrogate those layers, the more we'll find out about the history of that place and that planet. Also fun, the alpha particle X-ray spectrometer.
Yes.
Yeah. Turns out it's a much more capable instrument than its predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, a lot of history and heritage from almost 20 years now of rovers on the surface of Mars.
Yeah, she talked about how opportunity and spirit is, you know, different than curiosity right now, and how curiosity is way more better,
mm-hmm.
and how it can be really helpful to understand these different layers mm-hmm. On Mars. And she also talked about how alpha particles are created and how they actually detect it, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's also amazing to think they can package such a complex machinery into a small size that can fit on a rover, that can be mounted on an arm,
yep.
and analyze a rock that's in a rock that's on another planet. It's pretty amazing to think about.
Yeah,
what light ahead in the next lower they're about to say 2020, I believe.
That's kind of the projected plan now. Yeah.
So I don't know what kind of other amazing technology that will be on there.
Yeah, well, the science definition team just sort of made their report a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so we'll see. We'll see which instruments are proposed in response to that. But the APXS actually, yeah, I mean, this is a technology that wasn't available on Earth a few decades ago. And now it flies to Mars for the fourth time. And this one, actually, this edition of APXS was built here in Canada. This is the Canadian contribution to the mission. So the University of Guelph, with Dr. Rolf Gellert, prime contractor, MDA, and of course managed through the Canadian Space Agency as Canada's participation. And it is for this reason that we have Canadian participating scientists.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's, so, you know, it's a kind of typical CSA approach of a niche contribution. We provide the robotic arm and associated hardware for the space station, which is much larger than the arm.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide this single instrument to a much larger, more complex mission that allows us to have a significant participation. Yeah. Hand, if you will. Yeah, it is the part that reaches out and touches, actually.
Significant hand.
That's part. Right. That's right.
What's also really neat is what I heard from Emily's another student who went with you as a participating scientist to mm-hmm. NASA working on this mission is Curiosity is very, very diverse. She was talking about how you can actually zip lasers through the clouds
mm-hmm.
To understand what kind of, you know, cloud formation and things like what kind of clouds form and what's formed off and how they're different compared to Earth. And so, I mean, with the APSX and laser and things like that, for example, TAMCAM,
mm-hmm.
I think Curiosity is probably one of the best rovers we have made till now.
Oh, it is. It is a tremendously capable and a tremendously complex system. The spacecraft, I mean, it's really impressive. I got to do, when I was down there, I got to do a little bit of training in the mobility system. And my background is in mechanical engineering, so just to see how very capable just the wheel and suspension system is, never mind the scientific instruments on board that are, they do amazing things. But the, you know, it has 50 centimeter diameter wheels, and we were driving it in the Mars yard over obstacles that were taller than the wheels, which you don't get to do with most wheeled vehicles.
Yeah.
Now on Mars, we're not going to be pushing it so hard, because if we ever get it stuck, we'll never get it unstuck.
But, yeah.
But you know, the system is very capable. And yeah, this proposed investigation, this is through John Moores, about using the ChemCam system to study the atmosphere. You know, is something that we may well get to do. And that's what the participating scientist program is for, because that's not what ChemCam was designed for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a way that the system might be used. And yeah, we can look at the atmosphere. We can look at the surface of the planet. And there's a lot of things you have to learn. The suite of instruments there is tremendously capable.
Yeah, I think it's very neat that they ask other scientists to come in and bring different ideas of what else you could do. Because if you send one person and if you tell him to use this instrument, he probably just use it, or he or she would probably just use it the way they know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if there are people from different aspects of sciences, they might use it in a different way.
Yep.
And I think that is pretty neat in that way. We are actually using all the instruments on board for doing way many different things than you would expect it to do.
So as an example, the work that I do, the sort of the main thing that I'm involved with on the science side, is to use the rover's stereo navigation cameras to study the clouds in the atmosphere. And that's not what they were built for. The cameras were built for navigation on the surface. But as it happens, John Moores had done some similar work with the Phoenix spacecraft before, and as it turns out, you can take pictures of the atmosphere and watch the dust and the clouds blow by and get an idea of what kind of clouds and how much dust. So that's one of the things we're doing. And yeah, it's not the way that was planned, but it turns out to be a way that it can work.
Yeah. So, I mean, the person who actually built a camera wouldn't have thought it would be used for something like this, mm-hmm. but you know, people with different brains have different ideas.
That's right. And once you have a working system on the surface of another planet, you should really get every use out of it that you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I love Schmidt's work, because she actually compares, as I said before, both here on Earth, because over here on Earth, she also does missions to places where actually they have different layers, and mm-hmm. they study the same kind of, try to study the same kind of area in Gale Crater as well, and see how different or how similar mm-hmm. The history of Earth and Mars has been.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it's a lesson in how the same scientific skills apply in very different environments on very different planets, volcanoes on Earth, sedimentary rocks on Mars, but these are the skills that are transferable, just as the technologies are.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough in time to join us next week right here on astronomy.fm.